Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Goddess Project podcast. I am so glad to be back with you all. There is so much to talk about and so much to say, but I don't want to eat up too much of our podcast time. But I would like to say a couple of things. Number one, to all of you that are new, hi, my name is Dr. Carla Ionescu, and I am the Artemis expert. My work evolves, my PhD, my work post-PhD, etc. My teaching evolves around the goddess Artemis. I wrote a book, She Who Hunts. So if you're interested in the Greek Artemis, this is a fantastic start. I am now working on a book on Artemis of Ephesus, and I'll be going to Ephesus in the fall. So I'm very, very excited to have you all here. And if you are listening to me, as a new episode for the first time, hi, welcome, welcome. Thank you so much for subscribing. Thank you so much for following. Thank you for all of your support. To those of you that have been with me since the beginning or somewhere in the middle, hi, hi, hi. I am so excited to be with you all again. Right now, I am on the island of Corfu in Greece. A friend of mine has been very, very generous and has allowed me to stay at her home for a month. And so during this month, I will be catching up on podcasts. So I'm going to start uploading episodes again. I will be working on the mapping research. So I am working on mapping all of the temples of Artemis. In the world is the final goal, but I'm starting with Greece, obviously. And this past month, my friend Sandra and I, she is Images of Antiquity online and on Instagram. We were all over the Peloponnese, beginning to mark the temples. And I want to say that we found at least 20, 25 temples, photographed them, documented them, and we are now starting to put them on a map, on a Google map that is now, of course, on my website at ArtemisResearchCenter.com. So if you want to follow us along, we are doing like one pin or two pins every week, every couple of weeks. I'm also going to be posting a blog, a short blog on each of the places, a little bit of our adventures and getting there, because some of them, my God, they did take a long time to get there and find, but also a little bit of information on the spaces themselves. What else? Working on the book, working on the map. And I teach at the university and colleges in Toronto, Canada. Although I am traveling a lot, so I teach online. Oh, yes. And the Artemis Research Center is also a place for courses. So if you're interested in goddess courses, check us out. You can find us in the links below. We have a monthly goddess wisdom workshop series that's free. So you can join the center platform, and then you can join any of the free workshops that are available. And in the fall, we're very, very excited. My partner in the Artemis Center research courses, Cornelia, we are going to be running two workshops. Very excited about these workshops that we're working on. And I'll let you know as we get closer on what they're on. This month, July 20th, we are running a snake workshop. And I know there's tons of snake workshops, but what we're going to be really looking at is, why do women fear snakes? And perhaps why do people fear snakes? And so the workshops are very community-based. We are building a community. Our goal is to teach you a little bit and talk a lot. You know, that probably should be our little hashtag or our little logo, because that's what we do. I give you a little bit of a lecture, but we spend a lot of time talking, sharing, getting to know those of us that are in the workshop, et cetera. So it's a lot of fun. So if you'd like to participate in any of that at all, follow the or click on the links below in the description. And I think that's about it as far as quick updates. There's probably a lot more going on. I'm also writing, I think it will eventually be a book on all of my travels. I don't know. The goddess inspires me sometimes to write poetry, and she's put me through some journeys, and I thought maybe I'd share these, but that's a later project. And that's about it, I think, for now, as an update. Now, getting to our episode for today. Our episode for today is part two of the Cretan goddesses. Remember that I did Eileithyia a while back. before I left on my travels. And in fact, I have found another sanctuary to Eleithyia up in the mountains near ancient Mycenae, actually at ancient Mycenae. Maybe I'll post some of those in our community blog. First of all, it was a very long hike to get up there. It was really hot, but it's a beautiful site, beautiful. So I will put that on the maps as well, because to me, Eleithyia, Dictina, Britomartis, and Aphaea are Artemis, or incarnations, adaptations, precursors to Artemis. And so keep checking the map. Yeah. Sign up for the newsletter. Keep checking the map. We got a lot of stuff going on and a lot of stuff coming at you. Yeah. So today we're going to talk about this most fascinating adaptation, transformation. I don't even know how to word it, to be honest, because as I was doing the research, I kept going in circles, right? And the primary sources are going in circles. And part of me loves it because I think it's a great example of what happens in the ancient world around gods and goddesses. There's a type of synchronicity. There's a type of harmonization. That's maybe a better word. And movement, migration, travel, et cetera, of gods and goddesses. And their names change, or their names are borrowed. And so as I was doing this research, I was like, how am I going to explain all of this? This like is just a loop. And then I thought, no, you know what? This is exactly what we need. This is exactly what needs to be said or shown to understand how the ancients elaborated, created, expanded their gods and their divinities. So yes. So without further ado, I am going to share my screen. Zoom was giving me a hard time a couple of days ago. I was trying to prepare for this. Okay, let's see. Here's hoping that Zoom is not giving me a hard time. Oh, okay. All right. So it's working okay. It's not bad at all. Excellent, excellent. You can see me in the bottom corner, and then you can also see my slides. So if you are listening to me on Spotify, you can anytime take a look on YouTube for the slides. You don't need the slides to listen to this podcast. I'm a visual learner, and I like images. I find that they transmit a kind of knowledge that satisfies my thirst for knowledge. Yeah. But if you're an audio learner, this is also very, very perfect for you. So we're going to look at Dictina, Britomartis, Aphaea as Artemis. Okay. And so this is why I call them the last trinity of Crete. Now, as a little side note, I have found, how do I say this in short? I have found that the trinity of goddesses in the ancient world holds true. And what I mean is that I believe, and research shows, that the holy trinity, the original trinity, was always female. Now, we see a trinity in Hecate. We see a trinity, I have found the hecatomb of Artemis, which has three faces, which is amazing. And I'm going to love to share that with you I'm actually going to do an episode on hecatombs because I think they're fascinating. Okay. So I find that the Trinity, the Holy Trinity, or the three, or the trio, or whatever you want to call it, but I use the Trinity as sort of a word sort of hijacked by Christianity, that originally was women or goddesses. And the fact that these three goddesses, Dictina, Britomartis, and Aphaea, are almost interchangeable, but different individually, is a perfect example. And so I call them the last trinity of Crete, because to be honest, once the Mycenaeans, or the Mycaeans, like the Greeks say, once the Mycenaeans took over the ancient Cretans, right? I promised you that I would stop calling them Minoans, because the Mycenaeans called them Minoans, but they didn't call themselves that. Once they took over the ancient Cretans, and they sort of both conquered and appropriated that ancient Cretan culture, there was a movement away from the goddess. Lots of the artifacts that you find in museums show a very clear distinction between what were the ancient Cretans and what were the Mycenaeans. The Mycenaeans were very much a masculine culture, very much a warrior culture. They have a lot of horses, warriors, of course, a lot of aggression in their artifacts. The ancient Cretans were very much about beauty, very feminine, obviously very matriarchal, although that word has become more and more filled with meaning. Excuse me, more and more filled with meaning. But I'm going to use the word matriarchal. That is women's leadership in the community. Women represented in their art, goddesses, priestesses, etc. The Mycenaeans kept some of that because they were very strongly influenced. But you could see a shift in the mood or in the vibe. We went from getting along communally and having sort of a peaceful, loving, and I don't want to say it's kumbaya, but certainly it was positive, to an aggressive, conquering, and then eventually very violent mentality. I mean, we know that the most popular Mycenaean, of course, is Agamemnon in the story of Troy. So very violent figure, incredibly toxic masculine figure, no matter what Euripides tells us. So we see this change. And in Dictina Britomartis and Aphaea, you can see this change because this, how do I say this? Dictina certainly could arguably have been a Cretan goddess. And what, I mean, she was a Cretan goddess, but she becomes Britomartis in some ways, and then Aphaea, and then Artemis. And so the mood changes a little bit for her, for this one goddess that is three. So I'm so sorry if you're listening to me and you're going, Carla, I do not know what you're talking about. Now you're kind of spinning out of control. I'm so sorry. I'm telling you this in advance because that circle. So just keep in mind that I'm going in circles, and that's okay, that it's purposeful, and that it's what we got as far as evidence. Okay. And that if you feel a little bit like, whoa, that's okay. That's totally okay. You're with me. That's what's important. So let's begin with Dictina. So who is Dictina? Okay. And I will go a little bit back and forth with the myths because there are different myths for different times. Okay. So if we start early on, we know that Dictina was named Dicte, right? A nymph or a goddess that comes from Mount Dicte in Crete. And so she is said to have been named after this very, very famous mountain. Okay. Most popularly, we are told that she was loved and pursued by King Minos, but she didn't want his advances and she threw herself into the sea. But as she threw herself into the sea, she was caught up and saved by these nets of fishermen. Okay. And then because Minos stopped pursuing her, because she was saved by these nets and these fishermen protected her, he ordered this district, this area, to be called the Dictine. Of course, there's lots of stories. So again, I want you to feel very comfortable with stories that are almost conflicting, stories that don't make sense with each other. The ancient Greeks love storytelling, like all humans do. And changing the story and adapting the story and saying, oh no, I heard this version, or I know of this, it was totally okay. Yeah. So another story tells us that she was caught in the nets of the fishermen, or the Dictyon, and carried to the safety of Aegina. So we're going to see the island of Aegina. So we're going to see how Aphaea is established here. The island of Aegina is a small island just south of Athens. If you check out my social media or my TikToks, you'll see there's videos of the island of Aegina there and the temple of Aphaea. And we're going to talk about the temple of Aphaea and Aegina in a minute. So, but in this story where she is taken to Aegina, poor Dictina still doesn't escape really, because a fisherman called Andromedes, or Andromedes, attempts to seduce her as well. So she floods into the island's forest and disappears into the sanctuary of Artemis, who makes her into a goddess. So this is a long story. This is a short story of a long story that we're going to tell today. Okay. So she escapes King Minos, poor woman, goddess, nymph. She is then taken to safety by the fishermen. But as she's taken to safety to Aegina by the fishermen, she is seduced, or there's an attempt to seduce her, which in Pausanias's nice words, the use of seduction is, you know, how do I say this? Assault, right? So she is. So when we say that gods or heroes seduce a woman or goddess, the implication is that there's force being applied here. Very few times do we have cases where the seduction is consensual. Okay. In this case, we know for sure it's not consensual because she says no. She actually fled into the forest. And then she disappears into the sanctuary of Artemis in Aegina, which is really interesting. And Artemis has the power to turn her into a goddess. Now we're going to see that the goddess at Aethea is an invisible or unnamed goddess. And there's lots of different interpretations of who she was. The most popular is Artemis. The second popular is Dictina Britomartis, which is also Artemis. Yeah, I'm taking you for that loop with me. In Crete itself, though, so back in Crete on the island, Artemis, Britomartis, Dictina, these are separate identities and they have separate cultic contexts. Yeah. So Dictina, for example, had a temple in Mount Tityrus near Kydonia. So Kydonia is actually modern day Hania. So if you've been to Crete and you spend any time in Hania, this is the ancient Kydonia or the ancient Kydonians. And they actually are a large part, a fundamental part in the worship that we're talking about today, of Dictina, of Britomartis, eventually of Artemis, just outside of Hania or just south outside of Hania. There is a temple of Artemis of Terra. Lots of overlap there that happens in Kydonia and in the island of Hania. So if you go to the town of Hania, so if you go to the island of Crete, I highly recommend that you visit. On the island of Aegina, she was given the name of Aethea, as we talked about. Now, Dictina was a huntress deity, a deity of nature, a deity of the wild countryside, a deity of mountains. And she was worshipped fervently by ancient Cretans, perhaps Minoans, as a virgin goddess of the hunt, as a patroness of huntsmen and fishermen, as Patnia Theron, which is a mistress of the wild. So if you've ever seen that image of a woman holding on to the tails of two lions, or the butts or tails of two geese or different animals in our hands, this is often referred to as Patnia Theron, or mistress of the wild. There are some interpretations that say that the mistress of the wild, depending on the animal that she holds, may have changed names. Again, these are interpretations. We have no real confirmation of that. But Dictina is definitely one of these patroness of the wild, of the mountains. Of course, her name comes from Mount Dicte, which is one of the highest mountains in Crete. And coincidentally, the birth of Zeus. Yeah. So Zeus is said in one of the most popular stories of his birth to have been born inside the cave of Mount Dicte and raised inside the cave of Mount Dicte away from his hungry father. Dictina was often portrayed on Cretan coinage. So we know that she's an important goddess. And sometimes she's depicted with wings. Sometimes she's depicted with wings on top of an ancient mountain. And that's usually in her Patnia Theron imagery. So a very powerful divinity. Yeah. You could see if you're with me on YouTube. Sorry. My microphone is going in and out. Sometimes when you're on an island in Crete, the plugs and the internet and all of that is a little wonky. So anyways, So here we see Dictina on a coinage. I thought I would show you one. On the one side is the head of Trajan. And on the other side is Dictina. She's seated on rocks. She holds a javelin and she holds infant Zeus. Okay. And then there's helmeted Curetes on either side of her, helmeted sort of protectors, let's say, on either side of her. So an impactful goddess. Yeah. Now, pre-Zeus times, we consider Dictina goddess of the wild, goddess of the mountains, goddess of the fishernet, huntermen, etc. Post-Zeus, so post-Mycenaean times, post-Zeus times, she becomes the protector of Zeus. She takes sometimes the role of actually childbirth, which is really fascinating, etc., right? So because she's connected with the birth of Zeus, she becomes almost a protector of children, right? And this idea of child nourishment, which, as many of you know, Artemis is also then associated with. So this would have been an easy association, Artemis Dictina. Okay. But what about the temple? So I've climbed up to the temple or the sanctuary of Dictina several times. And it is a very, very, very tough road to get there. Okay. So her temple is on top of a hill. I would say a high hill. It's not really a mountain, on the Tityros Peninsula. And this is what's left. You know, it's a Hadrianic temple. It had lots and lots of activity during Hadrian's time. It was planned in the Augustan period, but it was never completed. So it was built on top of a Doric temple. So it's much, much older than the Romans, of course. But Hadrian is really one of the emperors that invested a great deal of money. It had a paved courtyard. It had colonnaded porticos. It used blue and white marble. It was really beautiful. And I'm going to show you the Artemis Dictina statue and where they were. So there were, around the temple, there were, of course, small houses. There were buildings to accommodate pilgrims across the water from the temple. So this site got so much pilgrimage. There were so many pilgrimage that came to see Dictina, Artemis Dictina, especially during the Roman period, that they had to build across the water. So it's in a bit of a bay. Most people get there with a boat. I usually get there with a car, but the road, so you go past the town of Rhodorus, and it's about 12 kilometers past that town, and it's 12 kilometers of what we call Greek roads, and the Greek roads are rocks and sand. So if you need a decent car, and still, even with a decent car, I usually stop about 5 kilometers in, no, about 7 kilometers in, 8 at most, and then I walk the rest. You can probably go a little further depending how risk, you know, if it's your own car or not. And then let's say you get to wherever you feel like, okay, this is enough. I really can't go on with the car. The car's taking a beating. You then walk a path to get to the bottom of the bay, which you're right on the beach, kind of takes you right on the beach. It's beautiful. This is where usually people come with a boat. And then from there, you walk up the so-called mountain, but it's more like a hill. And at the top of that is where the remains of the temple are. And it has a really strong feeling. I don't know what to say. I don't want to discourage you from going because it's a great site and I think everyone should visit it. But it has a feeling of a goddess that is quite powerful and maybe not always very happy, like a tough goddess. Now, Artemis is often this goddess. Often, Artemis is a tough goddess. And all my hikes to all her sanctuaries have been unforgiving, okay? Unless they're like made for the public and tourists, and that's different, but that's only maybe one or two. Okay. The one at Buran comes to mind. And actually no other one comes to mind. maybe the one on Acropolis, but no one knows it's there. So I've mapped it and I'm going to put it up on my map. But what I mean is most of the way to get to these sanctuaries or these temples is quite vicious, quite hard. So when you get up to the Temple of Diktina, you feel that it's both a reward, but also this cautionary aspect. So I can see why the ancients were drawn to her. She is a goddess that emanates power, and still her sacred space emanates that power. I think the second time I went there, I felt like a really aggressive force. I did go one time with my Patreon supporters. We went live while I was there. And it was really fun and great, although that recording didn't get recorded because Zoom. But it was really great to go there with people live. And that feeling was better. But anyways, so I highly recommend that you go there at least once. It is about 40 minutes away from Hania if you're ever in Crete and you have a car, or you can take a boat, and I think that's even shorter in Hania, especially if you're there in the summer. And a boat makes it easier because they drop you right in the bay and then you could go up to the site. Yeah. What's left there? Huh. So this temple is one of the oldest temples. We have finds there from the 7th and 6th century BCE. Okay. So this temple has been built and rebuilt. So we assume that in the ancient, let's say, Cretan / Minoan times, there was already a temple to Diktina there. And then as the Hellenistic period, and then we move through the Roman period, and all of these continue to rebuild on the site. So, and by the time we get to Hadrian, of course, he makes a whole new temple. He really likes it there, actually. He's quite, quite happy at the site. What's really fascinating is as you come up, you can see here in the image behind me, this white slab that you see there is the altar. This is the altar space. And it's quite large. And in fact, the only other altar that I've seen that's a little bit better kept, but this size, is in Mesopolis, Artemis Mesopolis. So what you come right up and it's right there. And the first time I saw it, I thought, oh, wow, they left this here. Of course, they left this here. This is a massive piece of stone. They also left other pieces, pieces that are broken. And you could see here in the images, you can see that there's these broken pieces of or artifacts that still have some frieze in them, some sculpting in them. One of them, for example, has like a flower or a strawberry, it looks like to me, or grapes, etc. Another one has maybe a torch or some other depiction. And then you see this one with feet. People have said to me, is it Artemis? Is it Pan? I don't know. Following Hadrian, if you go to her blog, she says it might be Pan, probably is Pan. So there's this, you know, debate about these pieces, but there's lots of pieces still left that have a little bit of the ancient art in them. I don't know why they're left, to be honest, but it's really fun to go to the site and see them for yourself. Yeah. So this was the principal center of Diktina's worship. Yeah. And we know that, like I said, it goes way back. You know, Herodotus says that it was there in the 5th BCE, but it can go back 7, 8, etc. And Herodotus actually says that it's a temple that the Samian colonists built at Kidonia. So when the Samians arrived in Kidonia, they built this temple. But again, most likely it was that there was a lot of building and rebuilding. So you have the Samians, you have the Polyrrhaeans, you have all of these people that come in and are just enamored with the goddess Diktina. They would come with offerings from all over Greece, from all over other parts of the Mediterranean. And it was the custom for them to go barefoot, okay, barefoot with their offerings to make direct contact with earth and nature, which was, of course, the goddess herself. And I tried to go barefoot. In fact, I went barefoot climbing up. But once you're up there now, like climbing up the hill, but once you're up there now, I only went barefoot a little bit because Greece is the most unforgiving climate for barefoot walking. Not only are the beach rocky, but Everything has thorns. Everything has thorns. Everything is sharp. You look at something and you go, oh, look at the pretty grass. And it's not grass. It's just thorny things. Okay. So I love going barefoot, and I love the idea of connecting to the divine or Mother Nature through walking barefoot. But let me tell you, friends, do not walk barefoot anywhere in Greece unless you are guaranteed that it's a soft pad. I've tried going barefoot at different temple sites, and you really can only make it a little bit before you get something sharp in your foot. So in fact, I went to one site, Artemisa Lemnaia in Sikian, where I was walking with sandals on. Obviously I had learned my lesson, and I had this thorn shoot through my rubber sole and into my foot, and I took it out. I have a little video of that. Maybe I'll post it. And it's, you know, it's like this long. And had I been walking barefoot, it would have gone through my whole foot. So do not do it. Okay. But when I say that ancient pilgrims used to do this, now, yes, okay, the area might have been cleared a bit, but I do not believe that the area was cleared completely, which means the purpose of walking barefoot on this tough terrain was that you are contacting with nature, yes, but also I would say bleeding a little for the goddess, right? Dictina, Britomartis, Artemis, these are goddesses that like a little blood. I joke with my friend Sandra because I've given so much blood in some of these hikes and other injuries. And I always joke with her that the goddess wants a little taste. Yeah. So lots and lots of brambles, lots and lots of sharp so-called flowers. Now, I promised you a picture of the goddess Artemis Dictina. So this is in the museum in Hania, and which I also highly recommend that you go see. So the statue itself is this beautiful white marble statue. And at the site of the Dictinian temple, there is still this circular marble piece, which you see here. And if you're not, if you're just listening to me, it is a circular marble piece. It looks like the bottom of a column, and it still has like a hole in the middle, which is how they would have kept they would have stuck something in there, a rod that would have kept the statue standing straight against wind and other elements, etc. So when you were standing on the site, this circular shape, the circular piece, is right at the front of the entrance to the temple. Then there's these steps that go up and et cetera. The temple is after that. So I imagine when I go up there that as I walk up, I pass the altar, and you would have had to leave offerings at the altar. Absolutely 100% the altar is there so that you leave. So imagine this lineup of barefoot pilgrims, and they are leaving offerings, whether it's little statuettes of Artemis, whether it's food, whether it's a sacrifice like a goat, whether it's jewelry, whatever it is, they are leaving it on the altar. Okay. And then they are proceeding past the altar and going right and up. They see the temple. Of course, the temple would have been massively beautiful. But there, right in front of the temple, is this statue of Artemis looking at them. And she would have been there with her dogs, two dogs on the side. Dogs are actually a great part of Dictina worship. She was said to have these massive black dogs. They kind of remind me of an idea of a one-headed Cerberus. Oh my gosh. Every time I say his name, or these massive black bears, right? So they're called black dogs. Also Hecate or Ekata, as the Greeks say, has also these massive black dogs. But we are told that Dictina at this temple, Artemis Dictina, had these massive black dogs that protected the site. So the statue of Artemis Dictina would have also had dogs. And Pausanias, I'm going to read Pausanias in 230. He says, she, Britomartis, okay, so he uses Britomartis here, is worshipped not only by the Cretans. Notice he doesn't say Minoans. Yes? Good, because who gives them that name? Yeah, Arthur Evans, right? Because he's all into the King Minos. Anyways, so Pausanias says, not only by the Cretans, but also by the Aeginetans, which are people of Aegina, or Aeginetans, okay, who say that Britta Martis shows herself on their island. Her surname among Aeginetans is Athea. In Crete, it is Dictina, goddess of the nets. Okay, so even Pausanias is doing the circular thing. Okay, so this is the way that this triple goddess was worshipped. It's fascinating. I don't know. It's so exciting. I don't know why. It's exciting because it's so multi-layered, right? There are so many multi-layers. So I thought I would give you a little chart here. Okay. Oh, actually, I have the quote right on here on my slides. But these are the three names from theoi.com. If you ever want to look at primary source quickly, theoi.com is perfect. As a starting reference, please follow up after that, as always. But theoi.com, for example, has these three names for Britta Martis: Dictina, Athea, and Laphria, which is usually Artemis Laphria. And we're going to talk about that at the end. We're going to talk about that after the podcast. Yeah. So she has these epithets: Dictina, Athea, and Laphria. And of course, Artemis is sort of the umbrella epithet. So let's move on to then Britta Martis. Where does Britta Martis come from? What is going on? Why isn't just Dictina the epitome of Cretan hunter virgin culture? Why Britta Martis? So Britta Martis is also a virgin goddess. I want to repeat, I know most of you know, that a virgin goddess for the Greeks means unmarried. Unmarried. Yeah. Not literally virgin, not physically virgin, not having sex, but unmarried. Yeah? And especially for goddesses, this is a goddess that never marries. Okay. So Britta Martis is seen as this sort of virgin goddess, this unmarried goddess of hunting, fishing, fowling nets. Okay. The catch from the nets, the small game or fish, etc., was served by the Greeks as a relish beside their staple meal of bread. Bread seems to be the domain of Britta Martis, or Britta Martis's mother, who is named Carme. Carme is Lady of the Harvest. So Britta Martis seems to have a better description of her parentage. She's also obviously originating from Crete, and she has the same mythology in Crete that the lustful king Minos attempted to seduce her, and she ran the length of the island and leapt into the sea, and then she was caught by the fishermen and carried to safety to Aegina. Okay, so these are compounded myths. You notice they're the same for both goddesses, and so you must ask yourself, well, which one was it? Well, it was both, and really none. Because let me tell you, between you and me, there is no King Minos. Yeah, that's a Mycenaean invention. Okay, that's for another day. But they're both the same, both sharing the same mythology. But interestingly, while Dictina's name is related to nets and fishermen and Mount Dicte, Britta Martis's name means sweet maiden. So derived from the word Britos and Martis. Okay, so sweet maiden, and it reminds me a lot of honey maiden, right? Sweet maiden, honey maiden, okay. And of course she is known as Dictina also, and she is identified with Artemis as well. Now there was a wooden cult statue of Britta Martis that was allegedly carved by the Daedalus. Daedalus, as some of you might remember, is famous for building the labyrinth at Knossos, for making those wings for his son Icarus, who tried to, you know, fly up into the sun and then ended up dying. So Daedalus is this great inventor. And there is this story that there's a wooden cult statue of Britta Martis that was made by Daedalus that was at the temple of Aulis in Crete. And she, in Aulis, she is often portrayed on coins. So I'm going to show you some coins of her because it's amazing. And of course, she's worshipped in those cities. And we're going to talk about the festival, Britta Marpeia, that was held in her honor. And as Dictina, She, as we talked about earlier, she was depicted in coins in Kidonia, in Polyrrhenia, and Phalasarna as the nurse of Zeus. So here, by the time, like we talked about, she's Dictina is depicted on coins in different cities as the nurse of Zeus. Britomartis is in different cities, particularly Aulis, as sweet maiden. So they're separate in Crete. You could see the separation, okay? But at the same time, there is this blend, certainly by the time that she gets to Aegina. By the time she gets to Aegina, she is one, which then eventually becomes Athea. Okay, you're with me on this. This, but Britomartis is a little more popular. Well, I don't know if I want to say more popular. That may not be correct. But she has temples dictated, dedicated to her in Athens, Sparta, Massalia, much more, I think, than Artemis Dictina. However, we are told that there was an Artemis Dictina cult object, which was made of black stone, that was worked on by the Aeginetans, which are the people of Aegina, and that was at some point left in the temple of Athea. So I know you're all with me, like all over the place, but I want you to think about more like these three goddesses as one, and how they moved around cities, and then they sort of blended, and by the time they get to Aegina, they are three in one. It's amazing. It's amazing. Yeah. There was also, for Dictina, for example, there was also a name for her, Pipituna, that was found in Linear B, which could be one of her names. And we're going to talk about Athea too, because so we haven't, you know, the truth is we have not, the things I'm telling you based on primary and secondary source are not all the things that were. And you might go, yeah, of course, Carla, that's logical. But I would say that we have barely scratched the surface of what was. And do I say this? It is such an incomplete story. Now, I'm doing my part to complete the story of Artemis. And every time I come upon one of her sanctuaries for the mapping project, I'm fascinated. And then we come to another sanctuary that's named the same as another one that's like three cities ago. And so I hope to one day put this aspect, because I feel like this is my calling, this is my passion, is the goddess Artemis, put this part together and sort of weave it together in something that might make sense. But I'm sure that for every divinity in the ancient world, and not just Greece, but Mediterranean, the Middle East, etc., there are these mysteries left. And so it's important work that we continue doing, that we continue following and unraveling and finding more and more meaning and information. There's also a butterfly named after Britomartis. I thought I just put that in there. It's in the genus butterfly family of Lycanidae or Lycanidae. I didn't know that, and it's very cool. And if you are on YouTube with me, I've put the male and female version of that butterfly here. And if not, you can just look up Britomartis butterfly and you'll find it. It's very, very cute. And I love butterflies. And in Crete, butterflies have significant symbolism of transformation, of course. They are one of the earliest cultures to use butterflies as a symbol, the ancient Cretans. So you can imagine the meaning of naming a butterfly in the modern period, naming a butterfly after Britomartis, the sweet maiden, perhaps the honey maiden, the goddess of the hunt of the mountains, later goddess Artemis. Yeah, like your mind just goes, wow, so much symbolism, so much meaning. Yeah. In Crete today, if you want to visit Britomartis and if you want to honor Britomartis, you can go to the Scotino Cave. Now, I, for some reason, when I share my screen like this, Zoom does not allow me to play this video, but I'm going to insert, for those of you on YouTube, a section here so you can watch this video. I think I also have it on TikTok, but it's probably somewhere down, I don't know, who knows how many videos ago. So I will add this to the visuals when I put this together. You know, I don't normally edit my videos at all, because I like it to be just you and me talking, but I'll put this in because I love this cave so much. This cave has so much power over me. It is the cave that I go to when I'm in Crete. I'm trying not to overshare. Yeah. It has played a key role in my life for the last couple of years. I go to Crete every year, and I hope to live there for a while and maybe eventually live there for good. How do I say this without oversharing? It's a powerful cave. I've gone into the cave. It's a massive cave, massive, massive cave. I've gone into it several times. I know there are people that have gone into the back of the cave, and I would love to join them one day, with flashlights and equipment and everything, because in the back of the cave, so the cave is this massive cavern. Okay. And you walk around it. It's beautiful. I think people even a rock climbed around it. It's full of doves and bats. So if you're nervous about that, be aware. Easy to get to, no problems. But it, of course, it darkens as you go in. And then the part where you actually climb down, you have to climb down. It's quite intense. And then go into the back. It's pitch black, right? Pitch black. But in the back rooms, archaeologists have found offerings, goddess offerings, votive offerings, goddess figurines, etc. In sort of these two back rooms, one was for worshiping and one was where they found all the votive offerings. So, which are now at the museum in Heraklion. So this cave has such power, and I've never gone in the back because I don't, you know, I like to push my luck, but I don't like to push my luck too far when I'm alone. In the back of a cave in the dark. I don't want to sprain an ankle or something go on. And then I don't even know if I can get, you know, Wi-Fi in there. So I would like to join some people who go in the back caving. I know there's a few groups that do it. So I will. Yeah. And then maybe I'll share that with you all. But if you go to Crete, I recommend that you visit this cave gently. Like, please don't take anything from it. The goddess in there is powerful. Be careful as you walk around because it's dark and there's lots of, like I said, birds and bats. This is the cave of Britomartis. So this was a cave, though. Let me start with, this was a cave in the Neolithic times in which people worshipped. Mostly women, we think, but certainly men might have been a part of that, especially in a matriarchal society. This cave has a long, long, long-lived power. A deity that I believe still resides or attends or shows up in this cave. And many others who have been there have experienced similar or even more miraculous things in here. This is the cave of Britomartis. Sometimes they call it the cave of Artemis, but originally it was the cave of Britomartis. And so it has a very powerful feeling. Yeah, it has a very unique feeling. So if you want to go somewhere, so you have a place in Crete to visit Dictina, you have a place in Crete to visit Britomartis, and there's several places, certainly Artemis of Terra, where you can visit Artemis. Yeah, there's several places for Artemis in Crete as well. One day, I would love to take you all with me. Yeah, one day soon. But first, the goddess demands my research, and she demands the things that I'm doing right now. And the time for visiting these places together is coming soon as well. Oh, actually, in Crete, Artemis also has the Cave of the White Bear. So if you're there before we get to go together, these are some places I highly recommend. But as always, you can DM me for any recommendations anywhere for the goddess. So Britomartis has this fantastic following in Crete. She is both powerful and virginal. She is blended with Dictina. Okay, so why does she leave Crete? She is one of the... I was going to say she is the only one that leaves Crete, but that may be not exactly right because there is some worship of Artemis Dictina in Greece as well. But she is the one that famously leaves Crete. And by that, I mean that she has several temples, several festivals, several aspects of her that thrive on the mainland. Okay. In Greece. Artemis, of course, does too, but I think of Artemis as the last addition to this trinity. So we've got Dictina first, Britomartis second, although don't quote me on that. It might not be an exact order because it's Dictina and Brutal Martyrs overlap. And then Artemis is certainly a third. I mean, I love the goddess, but the name placement and the worship that is adapted into her, this is a real thing that happened. I mean, we can't lie about historical events or make them up based on our fancy. Yeah. So Artemis, to me, the incarnation of Artemis, the divinity of Artemis, is a complete amalgamation of many Neolithic, pre-Neolithic, and post-Neolithic goddesses. You see what I mean? So that's okay. That's okay. And when she becomes Artemis and goes through, you know, 1,000 years or more as Artemis, later on turning into Diana or adapting into Diana, later on adapting into the Virgin Mary, these are the transformations of the divine. The divine is not static. And what I mean to say with that is I'm not offended that there are goddesses like Patna Theron, which is an unnamed mistress of animals, that predate the label of Artemis. Does that make sense? So Britomartis leaves Crete. Yeah. And as she leaves Crete, we now have an adaptation that we very clearly see has been Hellenistic Roman design. So in the classical context, she becomes the daughter of Zeus and Carme. Carme being the daughter of Eubulus, Carme being the lady of the harvest. We're told, according to classical context, that she was a nymph that took great delight in wandering about hunting and was beloved by Artemis. Yeah. But Minos, who also loved her, pursued her for 9 months. She fled from him and at last threw herself into the nets, which had been set by fishermen, or she leaped from the Mount Dictynium into the sea. So you see how by classical times, we have one story that absorbs all of these aspects, where she became entangled by the nets, but was saved by Artemis, who made her a goddess. And then we're told that she was not just worshipped only in Crete, but appeared to the inhabitants of Aegina and was therefore called Athea. Whereas in Crete, she received the surname Dictina. Okay, so this is from Diodorus, an ancient source, a classical source. According to another tradition, Britomartis was fond of solitude and had vowed to live in perpetual maidenhood. Okay, so by this time, maidenhood again, not marriage, but by the Roman period, maidenhood and virgin starts to have a bit more biological association. For Phoenicia, this is for this tradition calls her mother Carme, a daughter of Phoenix. She went to Argos. So by the time we get to the Romans, Carme, her mom, Britomartis' mom, is named Phoenicia. And we're told that this is after that she is a daughter of Phoenix. But think about the word Phoenicia and Phoenicians and coming from Crete and the Phoenicians moving around. Anyway, that may be another episode. Lots of association here suddenly, and perhaps not so suddenly, with the Phoenicians. Okay. And that this implies that Britomartis, Dictina, perhaps even Artemis may have been earlier represented as a Phoenician goddess. But anyway, so Phoenicia becomes the name of her mother, which was Carme. And Britomartis goes to Argos. So here we see a connection again with the mainland to the daughters of Erasinius, thence to Cephallenia, or Cephallenia, as we're going to see in a minute, where she received divine honors from the inhabitants under the name of Laphria. So I have given you here primary source that takes us through this entire loop. The Britomartis, sometimes known as Dictina in Crete, arrives on the main island of Aegina. Okay. Then travels, because she likes to travel, to Argos, to the daughters of Erasinius, then to Cephallenia. And there, in Cephallenia, she might have been worshipped as Laphria. Artemis Laphria is worshipped in Calydon, right? So, right? Your mind is like, what? But you can see at least one primary source that connects all of them together. Okay? Now, as what we're doing in this episode is we're kind of unpacking it. I don't like that word, unpacking, but we're kind of dissecting it. We're pulling it apart. We're trying to match this with this here, right? But this source at least gives us an idea of how this entire movement, this very circular movement and interconnection happened. Yeah. Now, there's this other interesting aspect in the Roman period that says that it was actually from Cephallenia that she comes to Crete, where she was pursued by Minos and she flees to the sea. Okay. So Antonius Liberalis tells us this backward story, right? And this is where the fisherman Andromedes tried to, you know, attempt on her chastity, and she fled and she disappeared into the sanctuary of Artemis. So you see how stories get looped, right? At the beginning, Diodorus tells us, you know, she starts off in Crete as Dictina, which I think is the most accepted story, and then becomes Britomartis, and then goes to the mainland and becomes Aphea, and then goes, walks around Cephallenia and other places and becomes Laphria or Artemis Laphria. But then we have a later Roman story that goes, well, actually it was from Cephallenia that she went back to Crete, and that's where Minos did this and blah, 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 blah. Yeah. So the spinning of tales is sometimes what really confuses a lot of ancient historians and classicists. And one of the reasons why archaeologists and classicists don't like to say, this is the truth, or this is what happened, because we actually don't know. We don't know. We just have what I'm sharing with you. Yeah. So these wanderings of Britomartis, especially since Britomartis is known as a goddess who loves to wander, indicate this gradual diffusion of her worship in various maritime places of Greece where she is mentioned. Okay. And then her connection and sort of ultimate identification with Artemis has this natural modification happening because they both have similar characteristics, right? So Britomartis is connected to fishermen and to sailors due to Dictina. She's the protector of harbors. Artemis is also the protector of harbors, especially as an Arcadian. She is, of course, a goddess of rivers, a goddess of marshes, a goddess of everything. So we see this overlap. And because Britomartis has the tendencies of Dictina, which is, of course, the huntress, the mountains, just wandering around the forest or escaping into forests, again, we see that modification and association with Artemis. Artemis is also considered a goddess of the moon. And Britomartis also appears in this light. Yeah. So her disappearance into the sea and her identification with Aphea, sort of at the top of this mountain, are associated as a goddess of the moon, right? And so there seems to be this connection that happens slowly. And in some coins, for example, in the Roman Empire, Dictina Britomartis appears with a crescent moon, right? Which we later see on the forehead of Selene, which then, of course, Selene is deeply embedded into the Mithraic tradition and, of course, later on into other Roman traditions. And as a side note, I have been fascinated with the Selene Artemis Hecate triad, but especially with Selene being the Mithraic pantheon. Anyways, that's another episode. But you see this blend, this overlap, right? So there's this, and of course, Britomartis is then, like Artemis, is drawn into the mystic worship of Hecate or Hecate, and sometimes even identified Britomartis Hecate. So there is a a long, long tradition of the blend of this holy trinity. So I'm going to read you Callimachus, because you know I love reading primary source. Because Callimachus, who's in the 3rd century BCE, okay, so right in there, talks about this overlap. So he says, and beyond others, Artemis loves the nymph of Gortyn, Crete, that's another word for Crete, Britomartis, the slayer of stags, the goodly archer, for love of whom was Minos of old distraught and roamed the hills of Crete. And the nymph would hide herself now under shaggy oaks and among the low meadows. And for 9 months, he roamed over crag and cliff and made not an end of pursuing until, all but caught, she leapt into the sea from the top of a cliff and fell into the nets of fishermen, which saved her. Whence, in after days, the Cydoneans called the nymph Dictina, Lady of the Nets. And the hill where the nymph leaped, they called the hill Dictaeon, or Mount Dictae of the Nets. And there they set up altars and do sacrifice. And the garland on that day, it's pine or mastic, but the hands touched not the myrtle. For when she was in flight, a myrtle branch became entangled in the maiden's robes, wherefore she was greatly angered against the myrtle. So she likes pine, not myrtle. So for those of you who are planning to make offerings, do not bring her myrtle. Not Bruno Mars, not Dictina, not Artemis here in Crete. O Artemis, queen, fair-faced bringer of light, you too the Cretans name after this nymph, Britomartis, Dictina. And these were the first who wore a gallant bow and arrow, holding quivers on their shoulders, Britomartis, Dictina. Their right shoulders bore the quiver straps, and always their right breast showed bare. It's very much an Amazonian reference, yeah. So here we have a 3rd century BCE source in Callimachus in the hymn to Artemis. And in the hymn to Artemis, Britomartis is named, Dictina is named, the whole story is named. Yeah. It's fascinating, a fascinating story. And of course, even the Amazons are named in many ways, because here we have the hunter depiction. So we've got the nets in this hymn to Artemis. We've got the mountain. We've got the hunting. We've got a whole perfect picture together. A side interesting fact, a fact about Britomartis is that a character named Britomart figures in Edmund Spenser's epic, The Faery Queen. I don't know if you've ever watched The Faery Queen. She is an allegorical figure of the Virgin Knight of Chastity, representing English virtue, but in particular, English military power, because in folk etymology, the associated word Brit, as in Britain, and Martis, which is associated with the god of Mars, which is the Roman god of war, is an adaptation. And so Spenser's allegory, Britomart become or connotes the Virgin Queen, Queen Elizabeth I of England. Yeah. So this idea that a Britomart is a warrior, virgin warrior, very much in the Joan of Arc sense, but in this case, British, because of the Brit in front of it. Yeah. So just an interesting side note. So what happens in Aegina? Okay. Because I haven't blown your mind enough yet, I'm going to tell you about the Aphea, the invisible goddess. Now, I have recently been to Aegina, as I said, and I went to the Temple of Aphea. And of course, the Temple of Aphea is modernly associated with Artemis, but very clearly there is an association with Britomartis, and as such with Dictina. The most fascinating thing about Aphea is that she only has, as far as we know, this one temple in Aegina. Nowhere else in Greece, mainland, islands, etc., is there a temple to Aphea. That's number one. Number two, there is no cult statue that survived, and therefore we cannot know exactly what she looked like. Okay. So let me tell you a little bit about, and you can actually get to Aegina with a boat ride, a 1 hour boat ride out of Athens. You can go there for the day. You can easily, you'd have to take a taxi or a bus to the Temple of Aegina and then make it back on the boat to go home. So I highly, highly recommend that you visit this temple. Yeah, it's beautiful. It's on top of a mountain, no surprise. Beautiful. So the worship of Aphea originated as early as the 14th century BCE. Okay, so this is the Mycenaean period, as far as our story goes. And the Minoans are in a decline, the Mycenaeans are in a rise, etc. She was a local deity associated with fertility and the agricultural cycle. Under the Athenian hegemony, she became identified with Athena and Artemis and with the nymph Britomartis, as we're told by Pausanias. Okay. So it's an interesting story. On Aegina, okay, there is a mountain of Zeus. Yeah. And the sanctuary of Aphea is up on this mountain of Zeus. the Cretans talk about this goddess. I was going to say character, but this goddess. And they say that Eubulus, who was the son of Carmenor, purified Apollo of the killing of the python. Remember that Apollo kills the python at Delphi. I did a whole episode on that. So if you're interested in why Apollo sucks, that's one. And there's also, of course, snakes and Delphi episodes. So they say that Britomartis, who was the daughter of Zeus and Carme, right? Comes to this place, right? Comes to this place where this so-called washing of sins of Apollo takes place. So it's a bit of a takeover of Britomartis arriving, running into the trees, and then building a temple to her already, or into the sanctuary of Artemis. But anyways, so Britomartis, we're told here again, or Aphaea, Britomartis enjoys races, hunts, and she was particularly dear to Artemis. So how do I say this? At this point in time, there is an attempt to, I don't want to say masculinize, but to add stories of other miraculous things that are happening at the temple of Aegina. What we know for sure is that we have no cult statue. We know that Dictina Britomartis arrives on the island. We know that eventually this mountain is, like I said, oh, this is the mountain of Zeus. That's why they built it there. But this temple seems to predate that tradition. In fact, at the temple itself, there are Neolithic and pre-Neolithic aspects. And so very, very difficult to try and take away the power of the feminine of Aphaea and of this mystery. So let's talk a little bit about the temple in Aegina itself. Lots and lots of finds at the temple of Aegina, and also not enough finds. Yeah. The sanctuary was set up in this outcrop of rock, which is the steepest on its northern and eastern side. So you could look down the mountain and you could see the ocean, and it's really, really beautiful. It predates, we don't know how old it was. There was other sites that were built on this site. But we know that by the end of the 6th century BCE was when it actually reached its final form, which is some of the form that we see here in still remains, that still remains. Yeah. There was a fire. So we find some findings around 700 BCE, and there was a fire around 500 BCE or just before that. And then it was rebuilt again. So what we're seeing here, what you're seeing in this image and what you see when you go there is the last version of the temple that was built. But we know that there are several versions of that temple within and underneath. So inside the temple itself, there is an older Doric temple that was probably erected in the late 500s BCE. And so that still remains. But like I said, there was a fire that destroyed much, much of the temple. The reputation of this temple is reflected in the marble statues of youths and girls that were set up near the temple to honor the goddess, works of famous Aegean sculptors. Many offerings were made by Athenian potters that dominated this place. And so we know that for sure, this was a place of intense worship, just like we saw with Dictina, actually, up on that mount in Crete. Like I said, around 500, there was a fire that badly damaged everything, and the temple was rebuilt. Yeah. Again, the Temple of Aphaea has no cult image that we have found of Aphaea herself. We know, okay, that there was an ivory cult statue of Aphaea that was rescued from the older temple and preserved, but the only thing that we have, archaeologically speaking, is an arm. One arm. We have one arm of this. And so that's a little tough. So what is the myth that is told in Aphaea? Okay. So remember that all these places that we've talked about, so Dictina, Britomartis, and now Aphaea, all of these have their own myths, but they're the same blended myth. So The myth of Aphaea is twofold, because there's two. So either she was the daughter of Zeus, who lived on Crete, where she was worshipped as Lictina and was said to be similar to Artemis. Okay. According to legend, and this is straight from the museum's inscription information. According to legend, the nymph Aphaea was pursued by the Cretan king Minos, from whom she escaped by jumping into the sea. A fisherman rescued her and brought her to Aegina. Okay. She disappeared at the spot where the temple now is. Okay. Now, you can imagine, Hellenistically speaking, that this makes sense if this mountain was so-called dedicated to Zeus, or the mountain of Zeus, that Aphaea, if she was the daughter of Zeus, she would come to this mountain and disappear, and hence the temple. As with the goddess Artemis, Aphaea was originally concerned with looking after children, the museum tells us. Her character is reflected in the small terracotta figurines from the early period of the sanctuary, 15th century BCE, so early Mycenaean period. They represent women who hold a child at their breast. As the over-life-size culture of the statue of Aphaea, which stood in the base of the cellas on the middle, only the right arm is preserved. It is raised and possibly grasped a spear. The statue was made of wood with face, arms, and feet of marble. So the main body of the statue is made of dark wood. This is very, very popular in the ancient world. But the arms and feet and face were made of marble. So that's one myth, okay? One myth. Another myth, again, also from the museum information data, another myth is the theme of a figured group of Parian marble. So there was this depiction that was created or sculpted, okay, which was originally intended to decorate the pediment of the temple, but it wasn't used. So in this myth, it tells us that the nymph Aegina was one of the many daughters of the Peloponnesian river god Asopus, who's a major god in the Peloponnesian part of Greece, and that this nymph Aegina was carried off by Zeus to an island, which was, as a result, Aegina, right? And that the son of Zeus and Aegina is Aeacus, the first king of the island, and his son took part in the first sack of Troy, and his grandson in the second. So at Aphaea, we either have the story that Aphaea is Britomartis Dictina, later Artemis, or another story of Zeus kidnapping another nymph, taking her to this mountain, and having a son with her who becomes the king of Aegina, the first king of the island, and then pursues a bunch of military pursuits. So you could see how the worship of a divinity adapts over time based on the needs or stories of the community. You know? So this later one of Zeus kidnapping Aphaea is more based on this piece of marble, this sculpture of marble that wasn't used for the temple. So we know that it is sort of the last, it's a very later myth, a very later retelling. And when I see it in the museum, or a drawing of it, because they don't have it at the museum in Aegina, but it really looks like Europa, when Zeus captures Europa and takes her away. And that's a whole other story, right? But this idea of Zeus taking nymphs and bringing them places and creating a whole culture, a whole thing, temple sites, etc., around it is very much on trend during this period. But we know from numerous dedicatory inscriptions that this temple belongs to Aphaea. We have a limestone plaque in which the priest Theotes talks about how this place was dedicated and built for Aphaea. We have lots of inscriptions that talk about Aphaea. So we know for sure that this temple is offered to this goddess that is worshipped only in Aegina, as far as we know. And we know that actually ancient writers themselves knew very little about her and soon forgot about her, because the Aegean state lost its independence in the 5th century BCE, and the sanctuary lost its importance. And so there was a poem to her by Pindar, who did not survive, but we really don't know exactly what kind of festivals they held. We know Pindar was a friend to some Aegean families. And we know that there was probably a chorus, probably a feast day of Aphaea, you know, usual aspects of that interpretation. Yeah. Now, is Aphaea really Artemis? This is a question that comes up a lot. Because as I walked around, so at the, there's a small museum right on the site of the temple, and it has parts of the pediment that, you know, were destroyed. And one of the statues that's there is a statue of Athena, a very cool statue of Athena, actually. I'm not a big fan of Athena, as you know, but I'm working on her, or working on being kind to her. And she was on the pediment, so it's not a cult statue or anything like that. But as I said before, the names of Athena, Artemis interlap more than we know, actually, more than we know. And I will bring that up when we talk about Artemis's sanctuary at on the Acropolis and other places. And there's, I found a couple of pieces, artifacts in which Artemis and Athena are hugging, in which they're talking. Anyway, of course, they're sisters, so that shouldn't surprise us, but we don't often popularly see them together. Anyways, so there is a statue that was part of the pediment, but the pediment had lots of pieces and of Athena. So we don't know very much other than the Brito Martis connection and the Dictina connection to Artemis. We name Aphaea Artemis, but how do we really know that this is another one of her names? So I found the small reference by Frederick Cooper, and he wrote about the Temple of Apollo at Versailles. And I have a whole story to tell you about the Temple of Apollo at Versailles. I was there in June. It's amazing. It's massive. It's great. And at the top of the mountain, right off from the Temple of Apollo of Versailles, is a temple of Artemis and a small temple to Aphrodite as well. So that might be a later, that's another video for another time. But I bring this up because the temple of Apollo of Versailles is in the Peloponnese. It's far from, it's in Arcadia, right? So it's far from the island of Aegina. And at the temple of Apollo of Versailles, we see an inscription, 5th century BCE, that was found in there that may be a dedication to Aphaea. Okay. And this would be the only inscribed dedication of the goddess outside of Aegina. And the inscription simply reads Aphaea. Yeah. So you know, is it a dedication? Is it a mention? Is it like, what is it? It just has her name. It's a piece of stone with her name. But I gotta tell you, it cannot accidentally just arrive there, because somebody, whoever brought it, came a long, long way to leave it there. Okay. And I personally believe that there may be numerous other inscriptions that, of course, we haven't lost because have been destroyed. If this is the case, it would make sense that Aphaea would have an inscription at the Temple of Apollo, because Apollo and Artemis are twins. And wherever Apollo is, there is Artemis. No matter what we've been told. In fact, I should say it the other way. Wherever Artemis is, there is Apollo. Yeah. And I believe that actually there are way more temples to Artemis around Apollo, near Apollo, at the same location as Apollo, that have been labeled wrong. I have a theory about a few things at Delphi that have been labeled for Athena that I believe are really for Artemis. But anyway, that requires a great deal of data and research to publicly publish something like that. But it would not surprise me at all that at the Temple of Apollo at Versailles, which is a massive temple, massive structure, that also had a temple or a sanctuary for Artemis up in the mountains, that there would be an inscription to Aphaea because of that brother-sister connection between the two gods. Yeah. So fascinating, fascinating. And lastly, before we move on to after the podcast, making it to the mainland, I absolutely wanted to share this with you, because here are some inscriptions of the goddess Bruno Mars. And I wanted to show you these coins. Oh, my head is in the way of these coins. This symbol here. Okay. So this symbol here has become, has become quite this kind of square, or two-thirds of a square, right? Three sides of a square with a, what looks like an A inside with a little circle or something else in it, has become a bit of an interesting symbol. And there's a lot of mystery around it. But we know for sure, for example, Pausanias tells us, and as I mentioned earlier, that Britomartis arrived in Sparta. So Pausanias says that in Sparta and Lacedaemonia, there is a sanctuary of Artemis Isauria, but her surname was also Limnaea, though she's not really Artemis, but Britomartis of Crete. So we have this connection of Britomartis to Artemis here. Antonius Liberalis, again, who is a later writer. Well, actually, he's a contemporary of Pausanias. He says Britomartis goes from Argos to Kephallenia, and the Kephallenians give her name Laphria. I mentioned that earlier, and made sacrifices to her as a god. So here we see that Laphria connection, which we're going to talk about in a minute. And Pausanias again later on says that in Lacedaemonia, the temple of Artemis Victina is a promontory in whose honor they hold an annual festival. So there is this tradition that we see here, yeah, where these three overlap. I mean, and so you're not shocked now after spending an hour with me, but what's fascinating is the continued primary source references that connect them. But what's even more fascinating is these coins. Yeah. So the first coin is the top coin that you see here is the bust of Artemis. So the one on your, on your left. Yeah, is the bust of Artemis, Britomartis, and she wears a pearl necklace, etc. And on the back of it is Zeus, who's seated. So we've got the Artemis, Britomartis, and Zeus connection here. Not surprised at all on this coin. Okay, this coin sold for $65,000. That's how rare it is. But the most rarest of coins. The most rarest of coins also comes out of Crete. And it's this middle one where Artemis Britomartis is on one side. Okay. And then there's an ethnic above a dolphin right here. Yeah. So this might be a dolphin. I don't have a very clear picture of it. But this kind of square, three quarters of a square with this, what looks like, I want to say like an A or a triangle in the middle, and there's dolphins in here. This coin is so rare that it's sold for $450,000. $450,000. Okay. And then I found this coin here, which is from Kephallenia, who has Britomartis on one side here, and then her symbol, which is again this three quarters of a square, and then what looks like in English, the letter A inside. Yeah. So not only did she make it to the mainland, Artemis Britomartis Dictina, but she became significant enough that she was minted on coins. Yeah. So being minted on coins means that you are in the culture, that the culture is using you to represent themselves, to create an identity. And so not only is she, are they, the Holy Trinity, the Cretan Trinity, sacred, worshipped, temple building, etc., but they begin to be the identity of a city or cities, Sparta, Kephallenia, etc., Aegina, etc. They begin to be Aulis in Crete. They begin to be the identity of that city. And that really elevates you to a new status, to what I like to call Tike status, which is a Tike is a guardian of a city. And Artemis is sometimes a Tike. Sometimes Tike is herself a goddess. Anyway, sometimes there's like an Artemis Tike or somebody else Tike, et cetera. But being a patron of the city, a guardian of the city, elevates you on the pantheon and the sort of pantheon levels. And here we see Artemis Britomartis Dictina elevated on the mainland and in Crete. In closing, I'm going to make this connection to the Temple of Artemis of Lafria. And I'm going to get into this discussion in after the podcast. So those of you who have been with me for a while, you know that after the podcast is a short addition to the podcast, this episode that I post for my Patreon supporters as a thank you for supporting me and for supporting this research, which quite honestly requires funding. Yeah, I mean, let's be honest. It requires funding because while being in Greece is affordable, hiking to temples, driving to places, staying in places and eating and all of the things that are required requires funding. So for those of you who have signed up and support my Patreon or who have sent money to the Artemis Center through PayPal and different ways to help me do this work, I'm so, so grateful. And so I like to offer you this special short episode or side episode to the episode, to the episode itself. But I don't want to leave those of you who follow me and are subscribers totally out of the loop, because I also think that's kind of a not a nice thing to do. And so I wanted to leave you with a taste of Artemis Lafria. Artemis Lafria is a version of Artemis that is worshipped in Caledon. And there's this connection because, as I said earlier, remember that Antoninus Liberalis, who lived around the time of Pausanias, talks about how Britomartis went to live in solitude in Aphaea, but from then she liked to wander around, and she went to Argos, and from Argos she went to Kephallenia, and then somewhere in there, in Kephallenia, she received the name Lafria. And the name Lafria, of course, is from Artemis Lafria of Caledon. And Caledon is a place, of course, for the Caledonian boar hunt, the myth of the Caledonian boar hunt. And so this connection made me think, Artemis Lafria, well, I've just found this temple. And I've shared here with you a picture of the temple, which I'm going to put on the map with lots of other pictures there. But Artemis Lafria is a very, very powerful divinity in Caledon. Of course, goddess of the wild and the wild animals and the hunt. That's how she's worshipped there. She has a temple there that was constructed around the 5th century BCE, right? So around the time of Aphaea as well. And has lots of sculptures. I'm going to show you some in after the podcast of what was found there. Fascinating stuff. And she had her own festival, Lafria Festival, which we're going to talk about next, which involved this grand procession and animal sacrifices in honor of Artemis. So the temple itself is right now being excavated. And when we went to go find it, it is actually a little hard and also very easy to find, as always. So my friend and I we climbed the wrong mountain, and we had to come down this mountain and climb another mountain to find it. Anyways, it's a large, large temple and has these fantastic views, as they always do. And what's funny is that traditionally this site, this area in Caledon, was more referred to more as the Temple of Apollo and Artemis in Caledon. But now, based on the recent excavations, we see that the Temple of Artemis is massive. And at the top of the mountain, which is the place of the highest, I would argue, honor. And then the Temple of Apollo is at the bottom of the hill, you know, which is nice. It's cute for him. I'm happy for him to have a little sanctuary there. But it's very, very clear that this is a goddess site, that this is a goddess space. But even as when I went to the museum, as you'll see next in after the podcast, they still say the Temple of Apollo and Artemis Lafria in Caledon, which irks me to no end. Yeah. But again, at some point, I'm sure that they will change the name. And certainly I'm going to do my best to play a role in making sure that people understand that this site is for Artemis Lafria. Apollo, yeah, he had a small sanctuary, but she is the ruler of all. So if you are so willing please feel free to join me after the podcast on Patreon. You can join any of the tiers to support my research, and you will have access to after the podcast. If not, that's all right too. Thank you so much for being here. I appreciate your subscription. I appreciate your sharing. I appreciate your listening to this. Feel free to send me comments and to, I don't know, like, share, or comment, whatever it is that allows my information and research to be shared. You know, the goal of this, the Goddess Project, is to bring more and more awareness in an informal way about goddess culture, goddess traditions, goddess in the ancient world, that involves an academic and, like I said, yet informal discussion. And so I thank you for being a part of this and for listening to this and for watching this, because it, the more we know, the more we talk, the more we share, the more we change the world. And as you all know, wherever you are in the world, we are in desperate need for change. And I believe that change is coming, and that change is coming in the form of the goddess. In my opinion, that change is coming in the form of Artemis, modern day Artemis, but it could be any goddess, and any goddess, and any sort of sacred feminine that we must return to or tap into or open up to in order to change ourselves, change our society, et cetera, for the better. So thank you so much for being here and being a part of this episode and a part of this channel. And I will see you next time. Next time, we are going to talk about the Amazonarchy, which there's so much to talk about there. Yeah. So we are going to look at some artifacts. We're going to take apart the Amazonarchy and talk about the defeat and the fights of the Amazons. So thank you so much, and have a wonderful day wherever you are.